Blog Talk Radio.
No, we'd like to welcome you to Missing Pages of History. As your host, Lee Robinson, today we'll be doing a compilation on the theme, the history of policing in the United States. As you know, this is a subject and a concern to all of the various communities within the border of the United States. And it's a concern because it has a history, a good, a bad, and an ugly. And if we are to move forward in the future century, we must come to grip with the problems that we are having as underserved communities as it relates to this concept of policing in the United States. To give us this compilation for this theme, we have with us Emmanuel Joyner, who is a contributor and historian. He will give us his compilations on the theme based upon his research, and we hope that this information will be of value to you so we can better understand this particular issue and phenomena and create a better relationship with this particular institution and make it become more responsible and accountable to the people, for the people, and by the people. So at this point in time, we'd like to introduce Emmanuel and say welcome to Mr. Pages of History, Emmanuel.
Welcome. Thank you.
Emmanuel, we're going to do a compilation on the four-part series that we have done so far on the history of police in the United States. As the beginning, can you give us just a general historical reference to the beginning of this whole concept? How and why did it get started?
Well, to do a summarization or recapitulation of our series on policing in the United States, first we have to get the origin. And I'm going to bring you that. I'm going to move you through pretty swiftly to where we are today. As I move you through the centuries and the different spectrums of policing, and you'll see how it relates to what's going on today. So the history of policing in the United States is closely followed by the policing in England. It all started there in the 1700s, early 1636. Again, the development of policing in the United States closely followed the development of policing in England. In the early colonies, policing took two forms. It was both informal and communal, which is referred to as the watch. Now, let's take the watch that is in reference today. It's called the neighborhood watch. So we go back until the 1600s, and this is where this all began, again, say, in England. But the first night watch was created in Boston in 1636, and it was basically volunteers who did this. New York followed in 1658, and Philadelphia followed in 1700, and was not a very effective crime control device. Most of the guys, they slept or got drunk on duty. They were basically volunteers. And most of them was basically evading the military service. And they were not scripted. Forcing the service by certain towns was a punishment for doing certain things that they did that was unlawful. So what you had was basically a day watch. Didn't have a night watch, just a day watch. So we move from that to a municipal police force. So augmenting that watch system was basically people called constables. And they were paid by the fee system by giving out warrants. And they served on a lot of non-law enforcement functions to perform in the city they were performing in. I'm going to move you along to what happened during the American Revolution. So now we're moving to the more modern police force as we have today. I'm moving now to the 18th century, 1830s. That's when the police department first got started in the United States. More like a centralized municipal police force. So, again, it started in Boston, Massachusetts in 1838. Now, the first American police force, followed by New York, Chicago, New Orleans, Cincinnati, Philadelphia, Baltimore. So, but by the 1880s, all major U.S. cities had municipal police forces in place. 1880s. Now, this modern police force had moved from the watch and everything else, but they shared a lot of similar characteristics. The cities I just aforementioned. Number one, they were supported and bureaucratic in form. They were full-time employees, not community volunteers anymore. Departments had permanent and fixed rules and procedures, and employment of police officers were fixed rules, procedures were fixed rules, and police officers, they got basically employed continuously. But last not least, police departments were accountable to a central government authority. So those are the four things, basically, I just mentioned, of the modern police force. And this is mainly in the northern cities. The southern cities took a different path. They were, the modern police organization in the South was called the Slave Patrol. I'm going to repeat that. In the southern states, the development of American policing followed a different path. The genesis of the modern police organization in the South was called the Slave Patrol. And the first slave patrols were created in the Carolinas, North Carolina and South Carolina. Well, we see why South Carolina has so many problems today. But the slave patrol only had three functions. Just three. And the primary functions were to chase down, apprehend, and return to their owners runaway slaves. First primary function was to do this. The second function was to provide a form of organized terror to deter slave revolts. We know some of those still exist today, like the Ku Klux Klan and others. Again, I'm going to repeat this one. This is what's going on today. To provide a form of organized terror, police departments have these groups to deter slave revolts, but not slave revolts, not today. I'll mention what we do today with the slave terror organizations. The third thing was to maintain a form of discipline for slave workers who were subject to summary justice. I think everyone knows what summary justice is. That's hanging, that's burning, that's bombing. This summary justice outside of the law, and that's what's going on today. And during that particular time, the summary justice was basically outside the law, but it was basically on plantation rules. If the slaves violated plantation rules, they were subject to summary justice. So after the Civil War, the vigilante style organizations involved a modern Southern police departments. And what this was to control freed slaves. Freed slaves was being controlled as part of the act that Jim Crow put into place. So we're talking about controlling freed slaves. Well, we're freed slaves today, and they're controlling us again, the same things. I'm tell you, you're going to relate this, what I'm saying today, what we still have today because of the history. So, controlling freed slaves who were basically laborers, like my parents, grandparents were, great-grandparents were, working in an agriculture caste system and enforcing Jim Crow segregation laws designed to do what? Well, to deny freed slaves equal rights and access to the political system. So these were the things that happened to then, or basically a little more sophisticated, is happening today. But what's the key question in the 1830s to necessitate the development of local centralized bureaucratic police forces? Well, number one, the cities were growing at a hilarious rate. They were no longer a collection of small cities and rural hamlets. Urbanization took place at a very quickening pace. So the old informal watch and council system was no longer adequate to control the disorder. So, that particular time, during the urban area became mob violence directed at immigrants, African Americans, and it occurred very frequently. We have the same thing happening now. The history of policing had that same format. It has that DNA, which you will not be able to eliminate. We can deal with it, but we will not be able to eliminate. But like I said, it became more visible and less controlled. So what happened after that? Well, more crime, more modern police forces emerged in response to disorder. So what are we talking about in disorder? We're talking about what types? We're talking about social disorder and public disorder. So that's during the 19th century and the 20th century. These types of things happen. So who defined the police procedures, rules, that particular time? The mercantile interests. You might say the business people. How do they do that? Well, through taxes and political influence. These are two major developments of bureaucratic policing institutions. These two things, taxes and political influence. It's all about the money. So these economic interests had a greater interest in social control than crime control. We're going to repeat that. These economic interests had a greater interest in social control than crime control. So, how are we going to fulfill these needs? They needed a mechanism to do this, to ensure a stable and orderly workforce. Well, how are we going to do this? Because the businessman, the mercantile, they want to conduct business and maintain it. And we call that the collective good. They want to divest themselves of the cost of protecting their own enterprise and transferring their costs to the private sector, to the state. But that is the history where we are and where we're going today. So the main thing was to maintain a stable and disciplined workforce for the developing system, but at the same time ensure safe and tranquility communities for the conduct, again, of commerce required as an organized system of social control. We got to control the social aspects of the disciplined workforce. As we move along, the only effective political strategy available to exploited workers was that of economic elites. And they referred to that as routing. Well, routing is what we do, what we have done in the 21st century, from the watch ride to all this country. So routing became a thing that exploited protesters, exploited workers. But it was a primitive form of what would become union strikes. So rioting and union strikes, basically, they put them in the same context. So now we need a little more modern than what we have, because now we're dealing with something different. Well, the first thing we want to do, modern police force, make sure we have a strong police force and make sure it was all male. It was all white male. It was all white male police force. And the main thing was to legalize the force, to authorize to use legal force to maintain order. Well, that's what we do today. Excessive force. We basically modified force to excessive force. So they needed, again, how are we going to maintain under the rule of the law? But that's not the rule of the law. You see it now, it's not the rule of the law. Everything is not done to procedures, not done to training, not done to this. So, again, social control was accomplished by raising the specter and less naming of class of people. These class of people was known as the dangerous classes. Well, who are these people? The underserved, people that basically was committing small crimes, people who protested, riots, political protests, mainly one of the main what we do today. So again, how do we use force to do that? They were called the dangerous classes. Again, who are the dangerous classes today? They're the same ones they were back in the 1800s, 1900s, the same people. So you're known as the dangerous classes. Who are they again? Unskilled, uneducated, underclass, political protests. These are called the dangerous classes. So for drunkenness, prostitution, these are the dangerous classes. Well, drunkenness was a big arrest period that particular time. Drunkenness was the area where they say, well, this is where we're going to make our money. This is going to be a stream of revenue. Well, what do? Public drunkenness didn't exist until mercantile and commercial interests created venues and encouraged the commercial sale of alcohol in public places. Didn't have drunkenness. You go to someone's house, they could drink this or that. That's where it was done. But now all of a sudden, the business people, so let's have nightclubs, bars, what we got today, same thing. And alcohol was where they made their money. They arrest you for drunkenness, fine, you make some money. But now, what is it today? Well, not quite as much as alcohol. It is basically traffic. Writing tickets for every little thing. Tickets are your avenue for the business sector. I was told by a young man doing a little research for me that in Ferguson, Missouri, they're broke, basically. The city's broke because they have to, you know, get rid of so many tickets that were bogus. They don't call it bankruptcy. They call it blackruptcy. I thought I'd just throw that in because, again, they have to throw away and dismiss so many tickets. That's how they made their money. 93% of those tickets were African Americans. New York, that's got rid of 860,000 summons. What's crazy stuff again? You know, tail light not working. One screw in the license tag that's arresting basically African American people. Of 850,000 summonses, over 90% were African Americans. Just to show you exactly what goes on, how they basically pinpoint a financial stream that targets the underserved, the underclass, which they call the dangerous classes. So again, that focus and social control and crime control persist today. The idea that policing should be directed toward bad individuals rather than social and economic conditions that are criminogenic and the social outcomes. I'm going to repeat that. The idea that policing should be directed toward the dangerous classes or bad individuals rather than social and economic conditions. This is what causing crime to be where it is today, where street crime, mainly street crime, and only due to these social outcomes. But to talk about the policing more, policing always been a reactive enterprise. Only occurs in response to a specific criminal act. I'm going to repeat that again. Policing has always been a reactive enterprise, occurring only in response to a specific criminal act. That's what you see today. The young student in Columbia, South Carolina, excessive police force, a reaction to an enterprise, the police department and the people they have there. And they responded to not a specific criminal act. It was a person using a texting with a telephone in the classroom. That shouldn't have happened that way. Many people, young kids, got their phones texting in the classrooms. The majority of the phones now are sold to people 7 years old and 21 years old, and they're texting. The instructor did not do the right thing. You call the police on some of this nature, and look what happened. Only because they referred to you as the dangerous class. That's why it happened. A friend of mine called me and said his son was texting in class, 15 years old. The instructor told him to put the phone down. Everybody was texting, but they caught him. And he told him to go to the office. He's going to take his phone and not give it back. Well, well, well. The kid is not paying that phone bill. That's his phone, per se. But his parents probably bought it for him. But right away, the parent, he took the necessary actions. He said, first of all, you can turn the phone to the office, but you're not taking my phone. That's not going to happen. You're not taking my telephone. You can take the phone from him and tell him to take it to the office. Oh, that's my phone. So you're telling a lie now. You're not going to take nobody's phone. Not my phone. I'm paying for it. So again, I got to emphasize how you prevent things of this magnitude. There's always a better way to handle that. You saw it the way it was handled. Why? Because, again, She was basically a dangerous, identified as a dangerous class. But again, the concept of police patrol as a preventive control mechanism routinely, in normal daily events in everyone's life, they're feared. You saw the police, the kids who were feared, but I'm glad they pulled their cameras out and took it, because there'd been some whole lot of lying you're about to get ready to go on. Whole lot of lying. Yeah. So again, the police departments in the early American stages, they had two primary characteristics where they still have today. They were notoriously corrupt and frequently brutal, violent. I'm going to repeat that today because it's happening today. In early American police patrolling and police departments, two primary characteristics exist then and they exist today. They are corrupt and they are very brutal. That should come as no surprise. Because they were controlled by, basically, at that particular time, early American, by local politicians. Well, look who they're controlled by now. Almost the same thing. The DAs, the attorney generals, they pick their own little, you know, their own little grand juries, they do everything. Again, corrupt. And control of leaders in most in the cities. They're controlled by police executives in charge of particular neighborhoods, underserved neighborhoods. But as I move along, as you see that I hope I'm making a lot of sense, a lot of common sense to you. We look at things from perspective that we should look at things. We got to look at the truth. This is what went on then in the 1800s, 1700s. It's still going on today. Nothing different. I'm going to move you to the post-Civil War era.
Emmanuel?
Yes.
Before we go to the post-Civil War era, we'd like to alert our listening audience that for those who are listening to us by phone, I mean online, by those who are listening to us online, we'd like to encourage, if you can, go and dial in on phone at 818-337-0016, so you can hear this entire program. If you don't, you can always go to our website, which is www.mphinc.org, and listen to this program and all of the other programs in its entirety. So again, before those who are listening to our program online, we ask you at this time, go and click in on your phone by dialing 818-337-0016 to hear the entirety of this program. Or we encourage you to go to our website, and that is at www.mphinc.org. And we encourage all our supporters there. Our next upcoming raffle drawing fundraiser will be December the 12th, and you also can go to our site to get more information on our upcoming activities, events, and we thank you for your support. Emmanuel, let's continue.
So I'm going to move you to the post-Civil War era. So as we move toward the 19th century, of course, the Union was organizing, things were happening, there were strikes, all kind of things was going on. Police took, they took two distinct forms when this happened. There were strikes against Pacific companies. I can go, just another history by itself. There were, public employees. They were doing the same thing. Private, private companies doing the same thing. But how are they going to disperse the workers when this happened? So the police force basically took two distinct forms when they did this. And the first was the most obvious, how you just disperse workers, saying they do protests like it did in Ferguson. the use of extreme violence was the first thing they used. That was, again, the second was to prevent organization workers in the first place and make public order arrests. But the two things that took place, police strike breaking took two distinct forms, protesters, they took two distinct forms, but the first, again, was to do extreme violence or excessive force. And the second was, of course, to, you know, to arrest them in public interest, another conduit to make money. So 80% of all arrests during that particular time or during these particular times or during when things like this happen, public order, 80% of the arrests for public order was made during strikes, during dispersing crowds, routing, protesting. But that's, again, another avenue of money with fines, a lot of police force. Of course, it's anti-labor and all of that type of thing. But that's what happened during that particular time. So anti-labor activity also, you know, reorganized some of the major changes in the organization of police departments. So what we saw, things came in front of us visibly, was alarm boxes were set up throughout the city. Everybody knows the little red box, the CW telephone was inside. So all these things occurred. And this, again, patrol wagons got involved, was instituted. But if, you know, hurt you up, put you in these patrol wagons, enlarge them of people because of protests and because of these type of, because of strikes, this type of thing. So police then, what should we do to identify police more? Well, that's when they first instituted uniforms. Should they be in uniform? They could identify them. Should police carry firearms? See, before firearms, they only carried nightsticks, but they made the nightsticks longer. You notice that they were short nightsticks from the beginning, but the nightsticks got to be almost 2 feet long. So how much force should be used? So these were compelling issues of the early American police force in 1890. So this is what happened. So, of course, the local merchants pushed for this stuff. Of course, again, we need to, so we can basically identify the police officers, and they got guns on this type of thing, is he better hope to create the obvious of their presence on the street. And, of course, the police, they want to, they didn't like uniforms that much. They didn't want that to happen, but it happened. Because the local merchants, they were the one pushing these things. And also pushing the guns because of mobsters and this type of thing. But again, the majority of citizens who bore the police, the brunt of the police, of the police power, the police had the power. So all of a sudden, early police officers, they started carrying firearms. Even it was not a department policy, they start, despite of the widespread public fear that gave the police and state too much power, didn't want the guns on the street. Look what's happening today. It's the same thing. The fear that this gave the police and the state too much power. So, what police departments did, since the police was wearing, you know, had arms, well, they informally armed themselves. So all of a sudden, the use of force to effect the arrest was very controversial in the 1830s and 1840s, and as is today, where they pull their gun up on your head, you don't have no weapon at all. You can't do anything, and they still got a gun pointed to your head. It doesn't make any sense to me. A child, teenagers, don't make any difference. This is what they do today. Because, again, this is their DNA. From the 1600s today, they are doing the same thing. They are armed. and they want protection, and that the 40th safest job in the United States is a police officer. The 40th, not the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, or the 10th. This is the 40th safest job in the United States of America. So why we need all this force, all these shootings? Why? And the first lie they say, I fear it for my life. Person ain't got no gun, don't have nothing, hands in the air, but I fear it for my life. It's the other direction, people. We should be fearing for our life. The value of armed and paramilitary presence like was in Ferguson, that is not necessary. It is not necessary. That is deadly force. And that's what you have seen. It's deadly force. Well, but it's what it deserves. It serves the interests of local economic elites who wanted to organize police departments in the first place. So again, the property tied elites, the ones who own businesses, who own real estate, against the property-less masses, who were regarded, again, as a dangerous class. So, as I move along to the history of police in the United States, I'm going to move you to the 19th century. And if I don't finish this, our next show, I will finish this. But, again, I will move to summarize, starting with the 19th century, and this is going to be a very interesting day-to-day in the big city political machines. I'm going to talk about the political machines, political contributions. We're going to talk about enforcing crime by the politician. We're going to talk about gambling, prostitution, drug distribution, and racketeering in the 19th century. While all of this happened, who was running this, and how the police force and the politicians commingled, and they became a machine era operation. We know about Chicago. We know about New York. We know about Boston. And we'll talk about prohibition, how the police got corrupted, and the opportunities for them to be corrupted during that particular time, and still corruption today with drugs. So we're going to talk about the major cities like New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, and I call bars basically speakeasies, how they ran these particular places, the mobs did, and how the police was overlooking that these particular crime syndicates, and how they basically became more directly corrupt like they are today. So they became more than watchmen for organized crime enterprises. In a more sinister vein, enforcement squads to harass the competition. Again, what did they do? They harassed the competition. Mainly the syndicates who was paying the corruption bills. I'm going to get into commissions that started. I'm going to get into investigatory bodies, that type of thing, how we got where we are today and where we are today. And we're going to talk a lot about corruption of the police department. And again, we're going to talk about investigating the police corruption, who investigated these departments and came away with victories, but at the same time, the corruption and the police of the police department and criminal justice system response. I'm going to get into that on my last segment of recapitulation or resummarizing exactly what we did on the history of policing. I'll get onto the national basis, that type of thing, and what's going on today, and I'll do the 21st century in my next presentation or policing, policing in the United States of America. So please get informed the next time around.
Emmanuel,
stay tuned for this. I'll be seeing you next time.
But Emmanuel, before you go, we do have time for one quick question.
Okay.
We're going to bring in caller 9289. Caller 9289. Your question or comment, please, quickly. Caller 9289. Your question or comment, caller. Callers, you have a question or comment? 9289? Okay, let's try this caller. Caller 7492. We got caller 7492. Question was caller 7492.
The only thing I was just wondering with the police of today, will you deal with the issue? Deal with the issue of them and
Emmanuel, the caller wants you to respond to the issue of voting and how to deal with the police today. The issue of voting, how would you deal with the whole issue of police today? In about 1 minute, if you just get some kind of your response to it before we go on.
Voting, if I forget the question correctly, how do police actually police the voting the way it's being done today? Well, that would be very difficult because the Republican Congress are putting up these stalwarts to make sure that the precincts and this type of thing have shorter hours to vote. They want to make sure that they get certain people at the line, basically. While you're working, they're cutting out voting on Sundays, basically, where most people vote after church Sunday. We don't have to work. You know, the workforce is much less on Sunday, and people usually go vote on Sunday. So any way they can basically stop this, and the police will probably enforce these through political reasons. Again, politics basically run the police department. Certain politicians do. They make sure they get their people in as police chiefs, as police executives. This is what they do. If you notice the signs now, that the signs when people running for office now, they have not an R or a D on the sign anymore. They have not no R on the D. So again, they're keeping us very anonymous. Hope I answered your question.
Okay, on that note, we'd like to thank our listening audience for tuning in this evening on Missing Pages of History. As we continue to fill in those missing pages of our history, we will complete our segment or compilation of dealing with the policing history in the United States on our next program. Again, if you'd like to listen to the entirety of this program and support MPH, we encourage you to go to our website at www.mphinc.org. We have a 4-quarterly raffle drawing contest coming up that will take place on December the 12th, as well as we have a monthly t-shirt and cap drive going on. We ask all of the communities in our areas where we are organizing and those who have access to our program to support us by going to our website and purchasing a t-shirt and a cap in support of Missing Pages of History. Until next time, let's all continue to strive to go forward ever, back on level, and let's continue to fill in our missing pages of history. We thank you and see you at the next program.
How was that? Pretty good?